This week we consider the Queen of Sheba and her famous visit to King Solomon. The details of the event are recorded in 1 Kings 10, 1 through 13, and 2 Chronicles 9, 1 through 12. The passages are virtually identical, so there is no need to read both of them. The Queen of Sheba is also referenced in the Gospels at Matthew 12, 38 through 42, and Luke 13, 29 through 32. Herein we read of how a queen from the virtual ends of the earth heard of Solomon's wisdom and came to see it for herself. She was not at all disappointed. In Jesus' New Testament reference, the Queen of Sheba represents the willingness with which the world accepted Solomon, as contrasted with the hard-heartedness of his unwilling generation. Your passage for consideration is 1 Kings 10, 1 through 13, and if you have not read it yet, I recommend that you pause and read it now. First, we ask, where was Sheba? Sheba was on the southern tip of the Arabian Peninsula, modern-day Yemen, and Solomon's fleet of ships would have passed there on their expeditions to India, which we have discussed previously. It is interesting to me that we read this account of the Queen of Sheba, but not of any other visiting dignitaries. We have it in 1 Kings 4:34 that people of all the surrounding nations and their kings came to hear Solomon's wisdom. I wonder then why it is that the Queen of Sheba stands out. I think that the reason is that she probably came from farther away than others. Sheba is, so far as I know, the place farthest south that is mentioned in the Bible, and it was on the edge of the Indian Ocean. In Solomon's day, Sheba may have been the extreme southern edge of the map, and so by explaining that even the Queen of Sheba had come, we understand that people really were coming from basically everywhere. A round trip from Sheba might have been as much as 500 miles. Even if the Queen and her entourage were traveling at a quick 20 miles a day, this would have been at least a 10-day journey for her one way. As one of the places relatively far off from Israel, Sheba receives little attention in the Bible. The word Sheba appears 42 times in the English Standard Version of the Bible, but most of those are as a person's name, not a reference to the place. 8 out of 16 occurrences of the word as a place name are found in today's passages. Most, or arguably all, of the other references to Sheba describe Sheba as a distant place of exotic trade in things like spices and gold. So, likely in the course of trade, the Queen of Sheba, who frustratingly goes otherwise unnamed, heard about Solomon and his kingdom. The news was that Solomon had wisdom from God, and so the queen decided to test Solomon's wisdom. She went to Jerusalem armed with hard questions. What those questions were, we don't know, but the passage tells that Solomon was able to answer all of them. That is to be expected of Solomon, of course, because he did indeed have knowledge from God. The queen was impressed not only by Solomon's wisdom, but by his buildings, his food, his servants, their clothing, the temple, and the sacrifices made there. Essentially, everything going on in Solomon's administration she found to be breathtakingly impressive. The queen remarked that when she had heard about the greatness of Solomon's kingdom in Sheba, she hadn't believed it. But as the saying goes, seeing is believing. Indeed, I am sure there are many today, scholars and laymen alike, who read the account of Solomon's vast wealth and the glory of his temple and who question the veracity of those claims. The Queen of Sheba serves as a witness for us. The account seems unbelievable to us, and so it seemed to her, but it was a true account. She saw it, she believed it, and it was real. The queen proclaimed the good fortune of Solomon's servants who stood before him because they would be fortunate enough to hear his wisdom every day. She also proclaimed a blessing on Jehovah for having done good by putting Solomon on the throne. Giving Israel a wise king was an act of love for Israel, because under Solomon, so long as he abided by that wisdom, the kingdom would experience justice and righteousness. We note here that groups of people almost always go in the direction of their leaders. Good leaders make for good people, bad leaders make for bad people. And then Solomon and the queen exchanged gifts. She had brought him 120 talents of gold. That's the same amount that Hiram gave Solomon in their city exchange, as we discussed last week, and it amounts to about 245 million modern paper dollars. That's a pretty hefty gift. She also gave him precious stones, type and amount unmentioned, and abundant spices, as had never been given before. Solomon also gave to the Queen of Sheba all that she desired. What exactly he gave her, we don't know, because the passage doesn't say, but I'm sure that he was very generous and that the two felt mutually satisfied in their trade. This apparently was the beginning of a trade deal between Solomon and the queen. Solomon's fleet of ships would have had to sail around the coast of Sheba and through the narrow Bab el-Mandeb Strait in order to further trade in more distant places like Ophir, that is, modern India. The Bab el-Mandeb Strait is only 20 miles wide, and even that is split by an island. According to Encyclopedia Britannica, the modern name Bab el-Mandeb is Arabic for the Gate of Tears, and the strait is so named because the strait was, in ancient times, particularly dangerous to cross. The Queen of Sheba would have had the power to block this narrow waterway and stop Solomon's ships from moving, so a good relationship between the two of them would have given Solomon significantly increased trading power. Verses 11 and 12 explain that, evidently as a result of Solomon's meeting with the queen, that his sailors were able to bring back not just gold and precious stones from Ophir, but also almug wood. There is some question as to exactly which wood almug describes. Apparently, the general consensus is that this was what we today call red sandalwood. It is a tree native to India and prized for its particularly dense wood and pleasant aroma. The problem with that identification, though, is that Solomon had also asked for almug wood from Lebanon in his discussion with Hiram, see 2 Chronicles 2:8. So far as I can tell, red sandalwood did not grow in Lebanon, so either Solomon didn't know where to get almug wood early in his reign, or he knew that Hiram had the ability to ship it from Ophir, while for some reason Solomon did not, or maybe we just don't know for certain what wood this is, or maybe almug was a broad descriptor that covered multiple different types of wood. Perhaps this is a tree which has gone extinct. The valuable wood, though, was used for everything from building additional supports to the temple to making prized musical instruments. Apparently, after Solomon's death, trade as far off as Ophir broke down and almug wood was no longer available, which I am sure made those instruments particularly rare and valuable treasures. Nearly 1,000 years later, in Jesus' lifetime, the visit from the Queen of Sheba is mentioned again in the New Testament in Matthew chapter 12, verses 38 through 42, and Luke 11, 29 through 32. The passages are very similar, but the one in Matthew provides a little more detail, so if you're going to read one of them, read that one. While Jesus was publicly teaching to a growing crowd, the scribes and Pharisees, that is, the educated religious elites, asked him to perform a sign. Now, we have discussed before that when a prophet brings a message and claims that it is a new divine revelation, he is expected to perform a miraculous sign to prove that the word is from God. Deuteronomy 13:1 gives the legal example of this, and we've seen the principle in practice throughout the scriptures. Now, it was downright silly, given the circumstances, for anyone to demand a sign from Jesus. Throughout his ministry, Jesus performed more miracles, and more amazing miracles, than anyone who had ever come before him. By this point in the narrative, he had already raised the dead, healed the blind, and helped the paralytic walk, among other miracles. It seems in this case that the religious leaders were not so much truly seeking a sign from Jesus as they were simply trying to find a way to discredit him. Indeed, as we have mentioned many times before, we often find that unbelievers are not unbelievers because of a lack of evidence, they are unbelievers because they refuse to accept the evidence when it is given to them, and the Pharisees in this case were no different. On those grounds, Jesus refused to give them a sign, calling them an evil and adulterous generation for asking for one. Now, we need to be sure not to take that verse out of context, lest we end up accidentally following false prophets. It is no error to ask a supposed prophet for a sign to prove himself. The error is asking for a sign after sign after sign, despite the fact that the overwhelming proof had already been given. Jesus said that the only sign he would give to the Pharisees would be what he called the sign of the prophet Jonah. Now, obviously, at this chronological point in our study through the scriptures, we have not yet studied Jonah, but he is a minor Old Testament prophet with a short 4-chapter book bearing his name. To give his story a quick recap, he was called by God to prophesy to unbelievers at Nineveh, but Jonah didn't want to do it, and so he set out to sea, going in the opposite direction, only to be swallowed by some giant sea creature. Jonah miraculously survived in the belly of the creature for 3 days before he was spit out on the beach, after which point he went straight to Nineveh and delivered God's message to a very receptive audience. In Matthew 12:40, Jesus said that his great sign would be like Jonah's sign, in that as Jonah was in the belly of the sea creature for 3 days and 3 nights, so Jesus would spend 3 days and 3 nights in the heart of the earth. This clearly was a reference to Jesus' upcoming death, entombment, and resurrection. Just as it appeared that there was no hope of life for Jonah, having been thrown into the sea and swallowed by a great fish, so it would appear that there was no hope of life for Jesus, having been crucified and buried, and yet, Jesus rose. It was an incredible proof that he came from God and rightly declared God's message. The Pharisees would see that sign, but Jesus would perform for them no other. While Jesus' great sign was comparable to Jonah's sign, it was in fact much greater. For a man to survive being eaten by a great sea creature is pretty incredible, but for a man to raise himself up out of his grave is wholly another. And not only that, but Jesus was here claiming ahead of time that it would happen. Predicting the future is a sign in itself. Jesus would be giving the religious leaders the greatest of all signs, and yet Jesus rightly predicted many of these religious leaders would still not believe in him. For that reason, the men of Nineveh, where Jonah had prophesied, would, at the final judgment, rise up to condemn the generation of the Pharisees. Why? Because they had repented of their sins and had followed Jehovah despite having significantly less evidence than the Pharisees had. But nothing would change the hearts of the Pharisees. When the judgment came, the Pharisees would not be able to claim ignorance. They had better evidence than anyone. And then finally, we reach Jesus' argument concerning the Queen of Sheba in Matthew 12, 42. Just as the Ninevites would condemn the religious leaders of Jesus' day, so too would the Queen of Sheba, whom Jesus refers to as the Queen of the South. Why? Because even on only scant evidence of Solomon's existence, she traveled for weeks to meet him and to hear his wisdom. The Pharisees could watch a man heal the blind and the lame, and they still wouldn't listen to his wisdom. The Queen of Sheba heard rumors of a man blessed with divine knowledge, and she ran out to meet him. Now, which one do you suppose was more righteous in the eyes of God? The Pharisees were obsessed with their pedigree. They were born sons of Abraham in the Promised Land. But the one who pleased God more was the Gentile woman from a place far off. God wants the people who will listen. He wants the ones who will hear and respond in faith by acting out the things which he would have them to do. And that's what the Queen of Sheba did. She heard and she responded even with no greater evidence than word of mouth. Surely if she had seen someone so great as Jesus, someone greater than Solomon, she would have responded. I am confident, though, that if the Pharisees had been in Sheba and had heard rumors about Solomon, they definitely wouldn't have gone. And so at the judgment, the Queen of Sheba will look with contempt on the Pharisees. Now, before we leave our gospel passages, we should briefly consider how long Jesus was in the tomb. Jesus said that as Jonah had been in the fish for 3 days and three nights, so he would be in the earth for 3 days and three nights. This presents a small problem for us because Jesus was crucified on a Friday and raised on the following Sunday, that is, at most, 3 days and two nights. The answer to this little quandary is that for whatever reason, the Jews tended to idiomatically regard even a small portion of a period of time as an entire period of time. We've noted before that if a king was on the throne for 1 year and one day, the Jews would count it as 2 years. Apparently, it is the same here. Jesus was applying Friday, Saturday, and Sunday as their full 24-hour periods of time, even though the full periods were not actually used. And of course, it keeps with the example he was making. Jonah 1:17 says explicitly 3 days and three nights, so in making his example, Jesus followed the same form. But he wasn't speaking of a literal number of hours. And so we come to our life application concerning the Queen of Sheba. The Queen reminds us of a principle we have mentioned before. People who reject God don't reject him because there is a lack of evidence. They might say that is their reason, but it isn't true. We know that there is a God because our chronologically finite universe must have behind it some infinite prime mover. We know that this God created us because otherwise we would not exist. Someone must have set the constants of the laws of physics so as to keep the universe in balance, and someone must have designed the complexities of the human genetic code. Someone must have breathed into us the divine breath. Human consciousness does not naturally arrive over time from nothingness and chaos. And we know that the only true God is the God of the Bible, because he is the only God who appeared to man in a real place at an actual time in history. And his appearances are the best documented events from the ancient world, witnessed by thousands of people, written onto scrolls by multiple witnesses, painstakingly copied down by generations of devout scribes, and preserved and distributed all over the world. I hear know-nothing babblers say that there is no evidence that Jesus even existed, but to believe that would be to erase all of history from ancient times, because no one from history is better documented than Jesus. We have four eyewitness accounts of his life. There are fewer accounts of Julius Caesar, and they are of lower quality. We have more ancient copies of the New Testament than we do of Homer's Odyssey. So far as I know, no educated person questions whether or not Caesar was emperor, and no educated person questions whether or not Homer wrote the Odyssey. So why do so many people question whether Jesus rose from the dead? Hundreds of people saw him after he rose, and his followers swore to it in court and gladly went to their deaths rather than to change their stories. If a dozen witnesses refuse to change their stories while they are being tortured to death, they're probably telling the truth. Courts gladly convict on lesser evidence than that every day. And yet we live in a hard-hearted generation. We live in a generation which is more concerned with satisfying immediate personal pleasures than it is with accepting the truth. And so rather than honestly weighing the evidence and coming to the best conclusion, many people tend to stick with the lie that will get them what they want. I had a friend once who told me that there isn't enough evidence of God for him. And I asked him, "What evidence will you accept?" He said, "I will believe that there is a God when I see video on the news of God coming down to land on the Capitol building and shouting, 'I am the God who created you,' and throwing fireballs out of his hands." Now, that's a pretty high standard of evidence, but I am very confident that if my friend saw that evidence, he would not accept it. He would just turn around and say, "Well, that can't be true. The video must have been edited." Even if the man was there himself and saw it with his own eyes, he could say, "Well, that was a wild hallucination. Someone must have slipped something into my drink." There is always another excuse for those who want excuses. The Pharisees from Matthew 12 demonstrate that. They watched a man perform all of these miracles right in front of their eyes, and they didn't flinch. They just said, "Show us another sign." The reality is that at one point in history, God did come down in a pillar of fire, and he was witnessed by a million people. And while we don't have video footage of it today, we do have the written account faithfully preserved for us. Well, that isn't good enough for the unbeliever, because just as a video can be edited, so too can a copy of a text. So no evidence can pass the test of a person who doesn't want evidence. Jesus was of a similar opinion. I cite for you his parable of the rich man and Lazarus, recounted in Luke 16. The rich man, Jesus told, lived in excess while Lazarus struggled in poverty. Both of them died, and Lazarus was received into Abraham's bosom while the rich man went down to the flame. From a distance, the rich man begged Abraham to send Lazarus back to the living, that he could warn the rich man's brothers so that they could avoid suffering the same miserable fate that he had suffered. Abraham responded to the rich man, "They have Moses and the prophets. Let them hear them." And yet, the rich man protested, evidently believing that his brothers would not listen to the prophets, and he said that if someone would rise from the dead, his brothers would listen. Abraham replied, "If they do not hear Moses and the prophets, neither will they be convinced if someone should rise from the dead." Well, indeed, someone did rise from the dead. Jesus raised multiple people from the dead, including one named Lazarus, and then Jesus raised himself from the dead. Many of the Pharisees still would not believe in him. And so today, we do not see someone rising from the dead with our own eyes. We have Moses and the prophets and the rest of the scriptures. No more evidence is necessary, and for that reason, likely no other better evidence will be given. What we have is sufficient, and we should believe it. If we won't, then there's no reason to expect that we should believe anything else either. So in our faith, let us follow the example of the Queen of Sheba. She heard of Solomon, and having not seen him, she sought him out. Let us hear of God's glory then, and let us follow him until that day when we can see him for ourselves. In reading this passage, verses 8 and 9 also stood out to me. In those verses, the queen spoke of how fortunate Solomon's people were to have Solomon as a ruler. She said that Solomon was wise and that he would give his people justice and righteousness. Under such conditions, his people and his servants were happy. By the queen's estimate, this was an expression of God's love for his people. Herein, we find the great value of having good leaders, and this is something we will see time and again as we go through the kings. When there are good kings, the people will be relatively good, and things will go relatively well for them. But when there are bad kings, the people will be relatively bad, and things will go relatively badly for them. Maybe this seems a little overly obvious, but the leaders of a people greatly affect the direction those people go. So this is something of which we should always be cautious, be it in governance of the church or of anything else. The appointment of bad leaders will cause harm to the people that they lead, and the appointment of good leaders will bring joy to the people they lead. So choose good leaders or else. To conclude, the opening of 1 Kings 10 and its corollary in 2 Chronicles tell the story of how, after hearing of Solomon's wealth and wisdom, the Queen of Sheba traveled to Jerusalem to meet him in person. She was very much impressed with what she found. 1,000 years later, in an argument with the Pharisees, Jesus cited the ancient story as an example of a person responding to a good thing even without a clear sign. It was a demonstration of the faith of the Queen of Sheba, and her example served as a condemnation of the faithless Pharisees, who, having seen many signs, still would not believe. And there are many, just like the Pharisees today, who would not accept, no matter what evidence they see. Jesus taught us that the evidence we have recorded in Scripture is enough for those who will believe. It is the evidence we have, and the evidence that we should accept. The Queen's dialogue with Solomon also reminds us of the importance of having good leaders. For those of you who are listening to this message away from your computer and are looking for more like it, you can find us at eastjordan.church.